Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the discussion about the offense, which would be just an awful discussion, except I have one of the most fun people to talk football with, Gordon McGinnis of PFF, joining me for this, commiserating in an awful loss. And the process is cathartic. Before I started football writing, it would ruin my whole week to have a bad game. Don't know how that was for you, Gordon, before you got working at PFF. And then you didn't need to wait almost till Sunday to get interested again in what the team was doing. Now I can get over it over the course of a couple of days of watching film.
Yeah, watching film, being able to talk about it. Like I even in the office today, because I'm spending some time here in Cincinnati just now, one of my colleagues is a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. And me and him have spoken about the game over the past day and a bit. That removes a lot of the annoyance from those things. I remember going back, like, I considered stopping watching the sport, not seriously, but like when the Ravens lost the 2006 playoff game to the Colts.
Ugh.
I was in a bad mood, I think, for about 6 months after that, and didn't really have an avenue to be able to talk it out. And being in the UK as well, like, it's not like I've got friends who are like huge NFL fans. I've got a couple of people who aren't, and it's grown enough now over the years that now I do. But back then it was very much just like, I'm just going to have to sulk about this for 6 months.
Yeah. And sometimes loved ones don't even understand the importance of that. It's like if I scream at the TV, you know, you got to let me feel, honey. That's just part of the getting over it process. That 2006 game, there was a work event scheduled. Why they did this on a Sunday, I don't remember, but there was a work event happened. There were some producers or whatever that were in town, and I was supposed to go meet them and play pool with them after the game. And I could not bring myself to inflict myself upon them with the way I felt after the game. I thought I made a very mature decision, you know, not to go there. But anyway, with the things we do for football. Let's talk some offensive line anyway from this game. Just at a high level, we talked about in the first episode, there were a lot of ATS opportunities, a lot of three-second pockets, a lot of room to step into his throw for Lamar Jackson in this game. It was surprising to me to go through the offensive line scoring and not really see that it was an unbelievably good game for the offensive line. They had some good moments in terms of getting things done. They also gave up some untimely things, and they had a bunch of flags. And that, of course, is a pretty serious negative. What are your high-level impressions of the offensive line in this game?
Yeah, similar to you, I thought it was better than expected in the passing game. Coming into it, I thought the Steelers were uniquely positioned to give the Ravens huge problems because they're really good on the interior. And Tyler Linderbaum, I think in general, that was the knock on him coming out of college. Like, how is he going to hold up against big, strong interior defenders, particularly nose tackles? And also the fact that the Steelers' best defensive player, or one of their two, because I think you have to include Cam Hayward there as well, TJ Watt does his damage off going up against right tackles, and the Ravens were starting a rookie right tackle. I thought it was really fascinating to me. Like, I thought the Ravens did a pretty good job, whereby I think Roger Rosengarten only had to block TJ Watt one-on-one, like maybe six times in this game. It was
sounds about right. Lots of chips.
So I thought they did a lot of really nice things in the passing game, less so in the running game. They didn't have the same success in the running game.
So one thing, maybe we talk about the individual players in just a second, but one thing that the Ravens seem to do a fair amount on the outside and is to just initially block the outside player with a Ricard or somewhere who can fight him a little bit away from the pocket and tire him, as opposed to a pure chip? Because it seems like a lot of tackles now in this league don't really like chip help, because what it does is it kind of breaks down your protection to the side they're being chipped to. That oftentimes you actually help somebody get free by chipping them free. Against Watt, which do you think serves the team better? Do you think two guys hitting him at once, or do you think that two guys hitting him sequentially is really been a more effective strategy?
I think sequentially for someone like TJ Watt is more beneficial. And there were like a good couple of plays in this game whereby I think Ricard probably was the primary person who did this, was able to force him out wide. And then Rosengarten then has like a little bit more time to kind of brace for impact and get ready for him coming in, which I think is important. I think you're absolutely right about how chips can actually have the adverse effect, especially if the chip comes on the outside shoulder and you actually help drive the pass rusher to the inside shoulder, it becomes quite difficult to block, and that can make it a little bit more difficult.
All right, well, let's jump right in. Ronnie Stanley, a pretty good season has been slowing down these last few games, as I've seen it for Ronnie. Not a terrible game in this game. Not a great one either. I'll tell you how I had it scored, and then you kind of tell me how PFF differs, if you would. Made 46 of 53 blocks, 3 pure misses, 2 pressures allowed. Those were fulls. And 2 quarterback hits he got half the share of. I don't know if you guys had him for any quarterback hits, but maybe talk about what PFF does when they're assigning an integer quarterback hit there.
Yeah. So we had Stanley for two hurries on this, in this game. When we were looking at the quarterback hits, or when we're defining who gets the official blame for a quarterback hit, if there is pressure on the play, so let me take that back. So let's imagine a scenario. Ronnie Stanley is blocking
Herbig.
Alex Heisman. Herbig. And Ronnie Stanley loses that block, and Herbig hits Lamar Jackson. That will be a hit charge to Ronnie Stanley.
Regardless of other pressures around. Now,
Regardless of other pressures around. If, for example, Herbig beats Ronnie Stanley, Lamar Jackson is forced to roll right. And then there's like he then kind of tries to, I don't know, scramble away up a little bit. And one of the interior defensive linemen kind of chases him down and gets a hit on him. The hit itself would be uncharged to an offensive lineman. Ronnie Stanley would be charged with a hurry on the play from us.
Okay. So the effect of that is that the PFF integer statistics are going to have many fewer than the total number of quarterback hits assigned to the offensive line. And in my system, I'll have fewer than that number assigned because there's unblocked players and there's skill position players who blow blocks, and there's a quarterback who holds the ball too long. All three of those can contribute certainly to various pressure events, but a little bit two different systems in terms of assigning that blame. So I've got two halves there for Stanley this game. But also sounds like maybe I have some cone pressures there that you didn't call pressures at all too, since I've got four in the game. And then he had the offensive holding call, 34 points in total, 0.64 points per play. I did give him a big adjustment because I thought Herbig actually is a very tough assignment. In some ways, he's 75% of Highsmith, I think, in terms of what he gives the Steelers, which sucks because he's, what, a second-year player now, third-year player, second-year?
I think he's a second-year player, really good player as well. Really liked him. One of those weird, Wisconsin have a habit of having those weird off-ball linebacker edge defender tweeners, and they just have, like, I think Andrew Van Ginkle with the Minnesota Vikings, who was with the Dolphins before, similar type of player. They just have a habit of churning those guys out. And I think he's a tough assignment for most offensive linemen.
All right, so a C for Stanley as I scored it. How did you guys have him in the game, roughly?
Yeah, so the overall grade was... Am I finding out? I'm trying to. 60.3, which I would say that's pretty much bang on.
Okay.
What a three is there? Better in pass protection than in run blocking.
Better in pass protection than in run blocking. Okay. I probably would have had it the other way around, but that's okay. Got to the same end point here. He had the offensive holding penalty. That would be a big docking to his run blocking. I'm sorry. I probably would have been pretty similar. Okay. So let's move over to McCary, who I think his blocking has been great the last few games. It's just the guy is now leading the NFL in penalties drawn. I saw on Twitter recently. I'd have to actually check that to make sure that's true. And that's actually not an easy thing, at least from my perspective, again, maybe you have an easier way to look it up for us quickly, but he hasn't played all the snaps this year. He had some rotational play at right tackle with Rosengarten before he moved to left guard. And if he's still leading the NFL in penalties, this is kind of like the curse of John Simpson showing itself up again at left guard for the Ravens.
Yeah. If you play left guard for the Ravens, you're going to have a whole bunch of penalties in there. I think, I've got it just like the total number of penalties. Laramie Tunsil is ahead. I don't know if that could have been impacted by last night. So Tunsil is at 16.
16?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't think last night he did it.
No. He definitely had one last night, right? He had one last night on the opening play, I think it was the big Nico Collins catch and run. I think it was an ineligible downfield. But it's interesting, his pass blocking and run blocking grade, Tunsil isn't overly impacted by that, whereas McCary, I think, is. So I would imagine that Tunsil could be more procedural stuff, whereas McCary is probably more of the actual impact on the play type, the holdings and things like that.
Right. So it's, I don't know if this is exactly what you're saying, but the difference in value of a post snap foul and a pre snap foul and a declinable foul is enormous. The IDPs, there is some question as to whether those are really 100% McCary's fault. And I understand the argument, but you've got to have a system for checking on that, whether that means, put mirrors where they need to go. They're obviously not allowed to do that, but just set yourself up with some way that you can get the quarterback into your peripheral vision so you don't take off early. And they've just had a big problem with that. And some of it is just the way that RPOs work, but there has to be a better way. It has to be coached better to avoid those penalties because they are so, so costly. And he had two, but I think both the IDPs declined 49 yards of yardage negated.
Yeah.
49 yards of yardage in this game. So that was pretty terrible. And the holding might've been on a 6-yard play or something, but it put the Ravens way behind the 8-ball in terms of down and distance as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And holding, I think, has a huge, huge impact because of it putting you in. So, a 6-yard run that takes first and 10 to second and 4, but then actually it turns out it's first and 20.
Yeah.
And it winds up being a huge deal. The downfield penalties as well. One of them in particular, I felt like it wasn't particularly close. Like he was about 2 yards away from the rest of the offensive line. And that's just not where you want to be in those plays.
But the other one, you thought it was close because that was the one where he kind of got slipped to the ground. He was 2 yards forward and then he kind of got up and moved another yard forward. And he was engaged out to that point initially, but that one didn't really seem fair. But again, no. I don't want to be the ticky-tack foul guy. I want to let people adjust the score as they see fit to do that. Anyway, minus 11 points from my perspective in terms of his penalties. He also allowed, I thought, 1/6 of that sack. And I think it was Keanu Benton beat him and Linderbaum split a double between the two of them. I may be on the wrong play because there were a lot of half pressures in this game. But I think it was him and Linderbaum that got beaten for 1/6 of the sack. That was really 2/3 on Lamar because Lamar escaped the pocket. So the initial pressure was bad. They're responsible for that. But then he escaped the pocket, held onto the ball, and eventually walked out of bounds with it, but without unloading it for a relatively short loss, like a 2-yard loss. But it was a case where most of that sack is on Lamar, but it's the absolute equivalent of a pressure that I gave these two guys in terms of the sharing for it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, and that's we had him with I think it was one pressure in total.
That had to be it then.
Yeah.
And two missed blocks is all I've got him for in there. I don't know if you can see how many negative scores you've got for him during the game, like minus 0.5s or whatever that it would be in the underlying data.
Yeah, I would need to bring up some stuff to look in at that. But I think we come in. Where did you have your? What was your kind of overall grade for him?
Overall grade was a C for him. It would have been. It's hard to say because the offensive holding was on a run. The two IDPs obviously are on passes. He had the 1 point on the sack. It's certainly possible to say he had a better job pass blocking, but it's really bad to give two options to the defense. In this case were very costly. So I feel like he's had some really good games recently, and I don't think he's at all close to losing the left guard spot. I see in this game, even with all the penalties.
Yeah.
It could have been worse. How did you guys have him?
Yeah, pretty much the same. So we had it like not far off where Stanley was. I think we've got him at 52.5, which is like, I guess a little bit lower, but not massively. The run blocking lower than pass blocking, but that pass blocking grade, I think if I understand our system correctly, I think the IDP penalties will hit the overall grade, but not the pass blocking penalty because the pass blocking grade is the actual act of pass blocking, not the kind of procedural part of like going downfield on that play.
Okay, so was this a case where both the run and the pass blocking grade were higher than the overall grade, and that would also support the notion that he had some after the fact adjustments that would lower it, or was it still between the two?
So in this game, he had a 52.5 overall grade, 58.0 run blocking grade, and then a pass blocking grade in the 70s. So,
okay, so that supports the notion that the IDPs were assessed after those two. That's great.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Linderbaum here. I didn't think Linderbaum had a great pass blocking game. Two half pressures. You could have called them full, especially if you use a system that does it that way. Half a quarterback hit. The 1/6 of a sack on the Keanu Benton play at him at 0.82, a 0.04 adjustment did bump him up to a B minus, but I do felt like he was party to a lot of that interior pressure. Part of why I gave him a big adjustment on this game, or fairly big adjustment for a center anyway, 6 blocks in level 2 and 3 highlight combination blocks. I thought he's been the one guy the Ravens have really been able to count on week after week in terms of having really good mobility work. And obviously a lot of that is a function of how the Steelers line up, who gets to climb to level 2 more often. But this was a game where he was doing most of the climbing and doing it effectively.
Yeah, and we came in here 53.3 for him. So like probably closer to where Stanley and McCarry were. But similar to what you said, like the pass blocking was where this was roughest. We had him with 3 pressures. And some of them were like pretty quick wins for the defensive lineman.
Right. I know one of them, he had Hayward. I think this might have been a half a quarterback hit where he basically pancaked Hayward into the cone, or maybe tackled him in the cone. I depending on how you look at it. Lamar had to scramble right, but then there was a disadvantaged block outside the pocket where you can't really, you know, toss it on Rosengarten, but it ends up being, I think he was the one it was an outside player there who it was his guy who beat him, but I wouldn't have blamed it necessarily directly on him.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right. Move on to Fa'alele. Ask this question after we go through this. I have him for 10 missed blocks in this game. And what I keep seeing, and it's only 53 total plays, so that's really bad. A lot of movement into level 2 and just not able to find anybody. I don't think it was as much decisiveness in this game, although that might have helped him by a block or two out of 10. He had some losses of the line of scrimmage. Half of them were there. He also had 2 total pressures as I scored it, and that was 1 plus 2 times a half. So it was really 3 total pressure events and worked out to be a D overall. So it would have been probably a worse pass blocking than run game blocking, but neither being particularly good is how I would say it.
Yeah, and we wound up a little bit higher in him in the running game, and that, like, for interior offensive linemen, I don't 100% agree with this all the time. Sometimes I defer to people who are a little bit smarter than me in this sense. For interior offensive linemen, the run blocking seems to have a bigger impact on the overall grade than pass blocking does, whereas at my kind of philosophical view is that while for an interior offensive lineman, your impact in the running game is obviously very important. If you're bad in pass protection, it kind of wipes a lot of that away. So, like, just to, a philosophical thing, I write up our PFF team of the week every week, and I pretty much have a rule whereby, like, I don't care what your overall grade is. If you have a pass blocking grade below 65, you're not going in the team.
There you go.
Because I'm just kind of taking that as a as a kind of standard thing. So, like, there will be, right? There'll be interior guys who have really good games in run blocking, but really poor games in pass protection, and they wind up with like an overall grade that's pretty high there. We had him with, I think, 6 total downgrades there. Which I think is a little bit less than you, but not a huge sum. And we only had him with, I think, 3 positively graded blocks. So yeah, his overall grade comes in at the highest, but his pass blocking grade was the lowest. So if you take the way that I would actually flip the logic, I think this would actually match up with where you have him.
I'm right on board with you on that. And I don't know if it was you or somebody else at PFF who's now told me how the original combinations of run and pass blocking were done. Might have been Timo, might have been Eric Eager, might have been Neil, might have been a lot of people, but that it was at center, it was something like 85% run blocking and 15% pass blocking, at least at one time. And that was kind of explaining Linderbaum's very poor pass blocking year as a rookie, combined with an outstanding run blocking grade that put him up in a top tier of centers, not number one, but in the top tier of centers, even as a rookie. And I thought, you know, it was really the explanation I'd been given. Now, correct me if I'm wrong about this, because if it came from you, I don't want to be misquoting you, was that without weighting like 85-15, you wouldn't find a lot of differentiation between centers because most of the differentiation was in the run blocking. But that kind of lets a player who's a bad pass blocker at center off the hook.
Yeah. So I know for a fact that wasn't me, because that description is way smarter than I'd actually be able to provide. that sounds like Eric or Neil. And it rings a bell with the logic. And I truthfully don't know, like, if it was those specific numbers, or if that still is what the numbers now, but that logic on like the differentiator there is where it comes in. Where I think it plays out especially is in single game grades. Over the course of a season, it tends to even out, and as the grades kind of stack on top of each other, those things kind of even out a little bit. But in an individual game with a smaller sample size, it leads to far bigger spikes there.
Right. I don't know about you. I'm perfectly comfortable with game-to-game variation of offensive line play. We're perfectly comfortable looking at baseball box scores and, you know, Gunnar Henderson hits 2 homers and drives in 4 runs. The next night he strikes out 3 out of 4 at-bats.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. What you get from a grading system shouldn't have to be all one way or the other in terms of its predictive value or its stable value versus just reporting what the fuck happened in this game.
Yeah,
I'm perfectly happy. I think, in fact, we're well served to have a system or systems that do both. And so I like that. Anyway,
I agree. The only other thing I was going to say as well is, like, I think there are, so like a lot of the negativity around PFF grades come from, you know, people who are like, you can't treat these things as gospel and all those different things. And I don't think anyone should treat them as gospel. I also think they get miscategorized at times. And I think part of this is on us in the early days, not doing a good enough job explaining this. So there is a lot of this opinion baked in, whereby if you look at PFF grades, that means that PFF says that these are the definitive rankings for these players as they are, right? And there's no allowing for fluctuation, like the cornerback, for example, like Sauce Gardner, probably at worst top 2 in the NFL among cornerbacks, but not having a season. Like, he's a top 2 cornerback. He's not playing particularly well. And like on the offensive line side and in the NFL in general, these grades are production grades. Because if you are an offensive lineman who is not a particularly good zone blocker, not a particularly good inside zone blocker, and you start for a team who runs mainly inside zone, that will lead to you almost definitely having a particularly bad grade. The next season, you could go to a team who run more outside zone, which is actually what you're really good at, and you wind up with a much higher grade. So effectively what the grades are is the kind of current production from that player within the system they are in. Because a lot of times there are players who are miscast, or there are small changes due to different schematic things and things like that.
Absolutely. It's very well said. So you're asking him to do a job that he's not particularly good at. And sometimes that's out of necessity. You know, a lot of the stuff, CJ Mosley had all that criticism for him as a coverage player in his final years with the Ravens, completely unjustified, by the way. He's one of the better coverage linebackers in the NFL, and he capped off his Ravens career during the regular season anyway with that 4th-and-10 interception that put the Ravens in the playoffs and at home. It was just a matter of, he's a guy who ends up being targeted because the rest of the secondary around him is so good. And it's not anything you should say the grading system is wrong because of it, or that CJ is necessarily wrong because the grading system says so, either of those.
Yeah. I also think in general, like for linebackers, I think it's a very, very difficult job in coverage, just given the space they have to cover. The other thing on the grading thing that topical just now, so I don't know if you saw this, but the Lions special teams coordinator last week, a guy called Dave Phipp, and the Lions special teams are really good right now. So a very good special teams coordinator, was with the Philadelphia Eagles as well. And he's become a little bit famous for just like when he's at the podium, just riffing to reporters and just like talking for maybe 10 minutes about something. And this past week, he turned his attention to DVOA and PFF and, you know, just about like various different things. And he had an example of when he was with the Eagles, whereby, and this was his way of saying that people shouldn't listen to PFF. And it was that another coach came up to him at a game and said, "Oh, your player who plays the like middle front role on kick returns." So this is the old school kick returns, the old way it was.
L3 or R3, yeah. Or whatever it would be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the front.
89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. But with AI tools popping up everywhere, how do you separate the helpful from the hype? The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at 1/3 of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With over 15 years of experience building responsible, secure AI, Grammarly isn't just another AI communication assistant. It's how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. Designed to fit the needs of business, Grammarly is backed by a user-first privacy policy and industry-leading security credentials. This means you won't have to worry about the safety of your company information. Grammarly also emphasizes responsible AI, so your company can avoid harmful bias. See why 70,000 teams and 30 million people trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise. That's grammarly.com/enterprise. Grammarly, enterprise-ready AI.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Front line of the guys, so if you're returning the kick, your front guy in the middle was the highest graded at that position in the NFL. And he was like, well, he wasn't particularly good. And the reason why we put him in that middle front position was because that was a position that didn't require him to make any key or important blocks. But he made the blocks, you know, because that in that position meant he would go up against lesser players. So he made the blocks. So he wound up with high grade. And from a definition perspective, like I understand for him as a coach, whereby it's frustrating when people are like, oh, PFF says that this is the best special teams player in the NFL, or he's the best player in this middle front position. And you as a coach know that you have put him in that position because he's not as good as some of the other players you have in special teams, and you want him to be in a more favorable situation. The flip side of that, and where I would say that we actually do, we do actually come out with the same general view on it, is that in the role you're asking him to do, and Dave Phipp himself acknowledged this, like, he was making the blocks that he was supposed to make. So because you have put him in the right position, you've put him in the right position whereby he has an easier chance to get a high grade because he's making the blocks that you expect him to make. So it's one of those things whereby I think probably what frustrates him and what frustrates a lot of coaches is when people just use the grade as like a, there's no context. This guy is a high grade, therefore he must be the best special teams player in the NFL. And that guy as a coach is like, well, I know he's not the best special teams player in the NFL because I've put him in an easier role to make it easier for him. When actually, if you just kind of join those two things together, you get, you as a coach have put this player in a winning position because you know that's going to play to his strengths and hide his weaknesses. And the grades actually kind of back up that you have done the exact right thing and it's worked out very well for you as a team.
Now, I've never heard Phipp speak, okay, but is there some part of you that's saying he's manipulating the conversation to sound like this? To basically take credit for the fact that this player is having an extraordinary season? It's not that.
No, it's not that at all. I think it's more just the general coaching frustration that I think coaches do get frustrated when someone will just use a PFF grade as kind of the jumping off point for a conversation, or take it as it is, just like there's no additional context needed. It's just this part. And his thing was just like, you know, he personally isn't interested in having that grade quoted at him effectively.
Let's take a minute on this because this is a topic that I think is really key, and it's probably something you guys talk about all the time at PFF, but how do you increase transparency to increase credibility of the grades while still having something to sell?
Yeah, so it's tough, and it's something that we've kind of got a constant battle of it. But it's one of the things that this year we've actually made a kind of conscious effort to do so. So we've done a couple of things. We've added a Discord channel whereby we like welcome people once a week to go in, and we'll have someone from the grading team.
What's the name of that channel?
I think it's just PFF or Pro Football Focus. Okay. We've put it out on our Twitter account. Okay. And people can hop in, and there will be selected times where, you know, you'll be able to ask some questions about a player's grade from that week. And one of our graders, one of our senior analysts, will be able to kind of like talk through like, yeah, like, you know, a fan will be, hey, I thought this quarterback, his grade was low. Can you kind of explain that? And the analyst will explain, you know, there were two dropped interceptions. These were the two plays, and you know, that kind of impacted those things. We also had a really funny thing earlier in the year whereby it was the game in Brazil where Rashan Gary had a sack while he was lined up opposite Lane Johnson. But it was one of those plays whereby Jalen Hurts thinks that one of the Packers players is offside, which I think they were initially, and then he gets the ball snapped. I think the Packers player just about got back onside and there wasn't a flag on the play. But it's one of those plays whereby the offensive line is not ready for the play to go. So the ball gets snapped. Rashan Gary gets round Lane Johnson. Lane Johnson does kind of half try to block him. Gary gets the sack. We had a stat a couple of weeks later around offensive tackles to not allow a sack yet this season, and Lane Johnson was one of them. And it got community noted on Twitter because Packers fans were like, no, he did allow a sack. It was Rashan Gary. Here's the play. Blah 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Because of community noted, it became known to us. So we then had a conversation with our senior analyst, with like Ben Stockwell, and got like, what's the best way to explain to people why we are not charging this sack to Lane Johnson? And we basically tweeted out a kind of longer version of the tweet, which was like, we're actually making a point of trying to be more transparent with these things this year. So yes, Rashan Gary gets a sack on this play, but the reason why this is not charged to Lane Johnson is because a Packers player jumps early, Jalen Hurts then gets the ball snapped early, the offensive line is not is not ready for that. So while you would acknowledge the fact that Gary gets the sack, and he does get the sack and does get credited with that within our system as well as the NFL, we wouldn't downgrade and we wouldn't charge Lane Johnson on those. And what was funny as well is, like, there quite often is contention between offensive line Twitter and PFF. Mm-hmm. All the offensive line guys were quote tweeting it, being like, yeah, like, this is perfectly reasonable. That's not, you wouldn't charge Lane Johnson.
But there
that.
Is so, normally some sort of friction between you and the rest of the offensive line community, you're saying?
Not even normally. I think it's improved a lot in the early days, because a lot of those guys are, and not incorrectly, a lot of their focus is on trait-based things.
Right.
Whereas our stuff is more on production, which is like the mm-hmm. stuff we were talking about earlier. So Daniel Falele, interestingly, is a pretty good example of this, I think. Traits-wise, not good.
One of the worst players you'll ever see. Yeah.
Gets away with a lot of it because he's so big that it's difficult to get around him, and he's able to, like, just lean into people, and it makes it hard to get off blocks. Whereby, and I'm not suggesting that he's a good player, but his actual production is a good chunk better than his actual standard ability, I think. So the offensive line guys, and a lot of times they were looking at that. And if you had, like, when Tyron Smith had a good few seasons where he was really badly playing through injuries, the offensive line guys still really rated him highly because he was doing all the trait things there, but his production was suffering because he was losing blocks just through not being physically in the same position and stuff like that. But a lot of that stuff, I think, because we've done a better job of trying to be a bit more transparent, has brought it a little bit closer.
Do you see a willingness from that group of people? And I don't want to name names here specifically. I mean, I know some of the offensive line names, but in terms of willingness to kind of put their own opinions out there on a play-by-play basis, like, how many people out there are doing scoring for their team, at least, that would be, you know, on a similar play-by-play basis that they would then want to compare it to PFF, as opposed to people who just watch the All-22? I suspect there's, okay, I don't want to toss this characterization on everybody, but I know there are individuals who just want to create a narrative about specific things, anything, not just offensive line play, but anything. And they'll find the three plays which back up their narrative. And you can always do that, but it's a hits per at bat profession. Guess what? There's offensive linemen get a ton of at bats, more than any other position except for probably quarterback, in terms of what they do on a play-by-play basis. In some ways, more than quarterback, because a quarterback on a handoff, you could call that a non-at-bat. But the question I have is basically, how many other folks are there out there that are doing this for their team and coming to you regularly and asking you, you know, what did you get? Is this a pressure on this play? Did you guys score it that way? Who did you give the quarterback hit to here? That kind of thing.
Yeah, so I don't know what happens kind of with different fan bases, but, like, there's a good chunk of people within the Ravens fan base who will reach out to me once a month, once every couple of weeks, to be like, hey, you guys had X number of pressures for this guy, or you had this grade for this guy. I kind of didn't see it that way. Like, where's the disagreement, or, like, what are those things? And generally speaking, like, the conversations I have with people are very friendly is probably not the right word, but, like, there is a willingness to learn. And there's also, like, on my behalf, there's a willingness that it's not, you know, sometimes it's definitions, sometimes it's that we see it slightly differently than they do. It's not a case of when someone gets in touch, I'm like, okay, you're wrong, and here's why you're wrong. And, like, sometimes you'll get a play where I'll just be like, I personally see that entirely differently, and I think this is, you know, this type of play and things like that. I do think as well, though, like, one of the big advantages with social media has been that, like, people have been able to grow into those things. So I think there are some really, really good offensive line analysts out there, like Brandon Thorne, who does some of the stuff with the offensive line masterminds guys. And he was someone who, he's been plenty critical of PFF in the past. But he also, again, I think it's similar to the coaching perspective with him. He gets frustrated on, like, just having grades quoted verbatim at him. And, you know, for those guys, they'll be putting out their own opinions on offensive linemen, and people reply to them and are like, well, they're grading like this and they're doing those things. So for someone like that, like Brandon himself actually now does his own kind of deeper dive analysis, whereby he has he scores sacks and I think potentially pressures as well now for pass rushers in the NFL, whereby he's going and looking at those guys, and it's not just the sack number. He's actually looking at like how many of those were plays where the pass rusher beat the offensive lineman convincingly quickly and things like that.
Yeah.
And interestingly, topical because of the game that we're discussing here, one of the big debates is always like TJ Watt versus Myles Garrett. And from a grade perspective, Myles Garrett generally comes out on top at PFF. I know when Brandon has done his things as well, the like high quality sack score for Myles Garrett is usually up there, like well among the best in the NFL. So yeah, those things
for most teams, do you think, for questions about that, or do you have local people, like if a Packers fan wanted to come and ask about how PFF scored pressures, is it somebody else that they would typically be contacting? Do you get mostly the Ravens questions?
Yeah, I get mostly Ravens stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
I just think that's the, and other guys, there will be fan bases whereby we won't necessarily have someone that's like semi-prominent within their fan base, whereby there will be an avenue for them to go and ask. And then we will have others like who it'll be easy for someone to jump in. It'll be someone they know within their own kind of community.
Okay. All right. Well, really do appreciate the transparency, and you guys have always been very responsive whenever I've had questions about things. Let's move to the last offensive lineman here, get that done, because we're well into this episode. We do want to talk about some skill position players. Roger Rosengarten, 9 missed blocks for him, so just a shade better than Falele as I scored it. 1 penetration, so he really allowed himself to get beat to the inside by TJ Watt on that 3-yard loss by Henry. Guys may have had it graded the same way. And 2 half pressures I had him giving up, which, looking at the end of this day and the fact that he had to face TJ Watt, he had a lot of help doing it. I still think that's an outstanding result.
Yeah, I think when you look through, and there probably only were 5 or 6 plays where he had to block him one-on-one throughout the entire play. And I think we only had him 1 loss in pass protection in that sense, which I think is probably the same one you had. We had 1 actually, in fact, in pass protection, it was kind of deep in the pocket, so it wasn't even a particularly bad pressure to give
up. It was a 12-6 block where he forced Jackson up in the pocket. Yeah,
that's the one.
I gave him a share of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought he did a really nice job in those plays. It was just a pretty limited amount because of the help they were giving him. And yeah, run blocking. So for this game, we had him as the Ravens' lowest graded offensive lineman as a run blocker. And we had him with 10 downgrades. 6 of those were more severe, so things that were like bigger losses in the running game or quicker losses in the passing game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and just going off of what I said earlier, I don't think any of the pass game losses were bigger ones. So, yeah.
Okay. Overall grade in the game, I had him at a C. How close for you guys?
Yeah, pretty, like we had him pretty much the same grade as McCarry.
Okay.
So it maps out pretty similar. Again, run blocking, even more extreme in this, the run blocking was far lower than the pass blocking.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, let's move on a little bit and, you know, I enjoy methodology discussion whenever we get the chance, of course, Gordon, and just hearing about the inner workings of PFF and some of what's going on, we really definitely want to catch up on, but I know the listeners want to hear about some skill position players. Who would you like to talk about?
Yeah, so Zay Flowers for me, this is a fascinating game because his stat line in this game could have been drastically different if not for kind of a couple of plays either way. So finishes the game with 2 receptions on 6 targets. They go for 39 yards. But if you go through the one I touched on earlier, whereby he's probably the second read on the play, and Lamar doesn't get there because Deontay Johnson's open, but Steelers defensive back slips. It's probably a 40 or so yard touchdown. Lamar then also misses him on one of the scramble drills. So it was the one on the left, towards the left sideline. Lamar just puts it a little bit too high and misses him on that. And then obviously the one we talked about earlier, whereby he's open early and then doesn't get his hands there. So this was a game whereby he could have easily had 100 plus yards in this game. There were just three plays that things just him and Lamar just didn't get on the same page. I do think you are seeing him and Lamar. He knows where to go for Lamar. I think the Ravens in general at receiver now are in a pretty good spot with this, where Bateman I think is good at it as well. But Flowers is good at finding that spot for Lamar to get there. And this was just one of those games whereby the final result just with a couple of things just didn't quite get there.
Yeah, with you on that, I particularly like the comment about the Ravens are doing a little bit, Lamar's being a little bit better, anticipating a broader set of receivers. So Andrews, he's had this connection with, of course, for years. And it's going to be a very tough day for the Ravens, possibly as early as this offseason when they have to move on from Mark Andrews. And, you know, they have Likely and the Kolar, and maybe they need to save some money. They have a bunch of guys they need to sign. Very possible Mark Andrews is going to be on the way out. But I think he's gotten himself into a good position with now several receivers. Aguilar, I felt, has been a good extended play target for him. I think, you know, you get some of that from Kolar. You get a lot of it from Likely, who he's got terrific rapport with. But I think they at least can do it now, where a few years ago, Andrews was getting so many marginal targets, it was really hurting his production, the number of contested catch opportunities he was getting as a percentage of his total.
Yeah, I agree completely with that.
All right, let me go on and talk about who I want to talk about here. I think I want to talk about Tez Walker, because you know one of the problems with the Deontay Johnson acquisition, which is fine as an insurance policy, is that Tez Walker is basically out of the picture at this point. I don't think he's gonna see the field offensively at any point. It's possible the Ravens will even need his spot for a return from IR or a signing or activation of a defensive back, whatever it might be. That acquisition of an interior defensive lineman is a possibility, but it's kind of sad that he's lost the year more or less from anything but a practice basis.
Yeah, and I think as well, I think that part's been a little bit disappointing. I also think the expectations on him coming into the year were astronomically high for a guy in the fourth round. Like, not within the Ravens themselves, but the fan base, I think. Because he was viewed as a steal in the draft, I think everyone was like, oh, this guy's going to contribute straight away and he'll be a deep ball threat. And, you know, I think these people were a little bit optimistic that, you know, he could develop into the Ravens' number two receiver. And that's just something whereby I don't think we do a good enough job yet of understanding that draft steals are not really known immediately after the draft. And normally when there is a guy who is a consensus top 50, 60 player who falls into the 120s or into the fourth round, more often than not, actually the consensus wasn't right on that guy. And there's a reason why they fell a little bit there. So that's something we at PFF are guilty of this as well, right? Day three of the draft, you're talking about the biggest steals, and it's the guys who you thought were going to be maybe early day two picks that have fall into round four.
Stone comes to mind. You guys had him very high, and he did end up being a steal.
He probably was one of the ones that actually was like a good one. But yeah, more often than not, the guys you think are steals, there was a reason why they fell.
All right. Another player?
On my end, I thought this was an interesting game for Henry, for Derrick Henry, because The overall game and his overall PFF grade comes in at 60.4, and that's because the fumble, right? The fumble early just tanks his grade. Or on a game-by-game basis, an individual game basis, if you fumble as a running back, you are capped at how high your grade is going to be in that game because the sample size is just a lot smaller. What I thought was fascinating in this game, though, is that he had a long of 31. So he averages 5 yards a carry. If you take out that long, then that gets you down to 12 carries for 34 yards. But I think that kind of highlights the positive and the benefit in the Ravens bringing in someone like Derrick Henry. Because where I think he adds value is the fact that he can generate big plays. It's not about him being the guy that goes and gets you consistently 5+ yards a carry or 4.5 yards a carry. It's the fact that even in games whereby he can be contained, the odds on him breaking out a big run at some point, like a 20+ yard run, are pretty high. And I think that's something that at the time of the pickup, I was quite excited about for the Ravens. And even in a game whereby, you know, this is, I think, his worst game for the team so far, you still saw some of that stuff, which I think bodes well for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I'm obviously not happy with the fumble. Also, I'm not terribly concerned about the not running Henry enough component of this, other than the fact that I think stylistically this would have been a good game to try and reduce your number of defensive snaps from strategically. It would have been a good decision to do that. We talked about that a little bit earlier, but they got behind the eight ball so regularly. I'm not sure running the ball wouldn't have led to more holding calls. You know, and they would have been just more behind the sticks there. And they've been very good, by the way, this year at coming back from holding calls. McCary, I want to say his first, he had 5 holding calls and 0 had stalled drives coming into, might have been into last week or maybe coming into this week even. That's a pretty remarkable stat there all unto itself, because holding calls will very often stall a drive. I think surprising that. And so I don't really trust the Ravens offensive line to avoid holding calls and not create the kind of problems that they did in this game as it turned out. I think both of them were run holds, right? One was on the run, one was a 6-yard run left that went to Stanley, and the other one was on McCary. And I'm forgetting the exact play it occurred on, but both were on runs, not on passes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely correct.
All right. I think maybe that's enough. Let me just see if we've got anything in the mailbag going on right now. If we do, and I know we had a question that I took in on a bad side of this. Okay, here we go. This is funny and totally topical too. Lyman's Backpack asks, could we save 2 penalties per game if McCary declares as an eligible receiver on every play? This is just a joke. Humor helps with the pain.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I think he'd have to go out for a pass in order to avoid those. But he might pick him up in OPIs anyway.
That strikes me as something that the Bill Belichick Patriots would do.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. All right. Here's another one from Minion Hunter. He's a regular fan, gives a lot of great questions here. If the Ravens wanted to target Johnson for the Steelers game, why did they do it? Why didn't they do it after they had a lead? Why disrupt the regular chemistry before they settled down? So did the Ravens lead at any point in this game? Maybe 7-6 or something?
I think they did. I think they led 7-6.
Okay. So they're very brief opportunity there, obviously, to do it. And if you're saying, you know, they might have had an opportunity to get the lead when they on the drives that they threw to Johnson, you could very well be correct. They also missed some field goals I guess I'd have to say if they missed plays to Johnson, they could have been, in theory, drive stalling plays in and of themselves. I don't think you can get it done that easily. I think you need to script the plays you can script. They probably had a couple of their scripted bag of 15 to 20 plays that were going to Johnson. I just don't think they were executed all that well.
And yeah,
part of it was.
I agree, and they did their opportunity to do so with a lead was really limited, actually, because I think they might have only touched the ball once with a lead, and I think it was right at the end of the half on like the one play drive for the Isaiah Likely, yeah. And then after that, the Steelers were back in front, and I don't think the Ravens ever got back in front again after that.
Yeah. All right. always a pleasure talking football with you, Gordon. Thanks for taking a couple hours to speak. I know you have probably other things you could be doing with your time that would be better, but Ravens fans, I'm sure, really appreciate it. Tell folks where they can contact you online and talk football or ask questions about their favorite scoring question.
Yeah, you'll find me still on Twitter, PFF_Gordon. Like, please reach out anytime you have questions. I'm more than happy to answer. And this was a good way to spend some time on a Tuesday evening.
All right, appreciate it, Gordon. Other folks out there, thanks for your loyalty. I know if you're listening to this after 2 hours of content here, you're one of our best listeners. Please consider a 50 word 5-star review that hopefully will only take you 5 minutes to write. And if you can, tell somebody new about this podcast. You know, most of what happens is word of mouth and not algorithmically generated. And I always appreciate when people tell somebody new about the show. Gordon, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.